Welcome to the Sunday Night There is a Solution newcomer and returning members meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. Visit our website at oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed to those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. And we will now introduce our speaker, a member who has at least 6 months of abstinence, has recovered through the directions in the Big Book, and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After the share, there will be time to make a comment or ask a question about the OA program or what the speaker has shared. And please help me welcome Craig F., a compulsive overeater from Oklahoma.
Okay, thank you. I'm assuming I can be heard and ready to go. This is Craig F., and I'm recovered in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Can I be heard?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. The head's nodding. All right. Well, thank you for asking me to speak. When I was new in the program, my very first sponsor told me that I never had the right to say no unless I just couldn't get there, that if somebody asked me to speak, that it was my obligation to share what the program had meant to me, that if I really truly was grateful for what the program did, that I needed to pass it on, share, and be available to share my experience, strength, and hope. And I've always taken that thought to heart. So I'll begin. I was pretty young when I was born. I was born in Kansas back in the early 50s. I'm an old man. Typical, you know, my dad, World War II veteran. My parents were children of the Depression. My mom particularly had it very rough in the Depression. She was one of 15 kids growing up with a dad that had been injured pretty severely in the winter of 32. So they went without food at times. And part of my story, part, you know, one time I kind of thought that the reason I had a food problem was that she used to scare us to death at mealtimes by telling us stories of near starvation as a child, and that you know, and then we were to eat, and then she controlled the food, the food portions. After that, she put a portion on your plate. You were to eat that. You didn't, you know, maybe you got seconds and maybe you didn't, but you ate what you were given and you cleaned up your plate. And I thought, having seen all that and figured that out, that I knew the causes, and being the engineer that I am, I thought once I had that figured out that I could fix it. But, you know, doesn't work that way. The human mind isn't like an automobile. You know, just if I know what's wrong with my, I'm having trouble with my truck right now, and they can't figure out what's wrong with it. There's a valve sticking in the transmission or something, and every now and then it won't shift. If we knew what was wrong, we could replace that valve and fix it, you know, maybe make an adjustment. But just because I may know the causes, or may not know the causes of this disease, that doesn't mean that I can stick a screwdriver in my ear and turn a valve, or adjust a setting, or log in with a computer and make a change to the programming, and that everything's going to operate all right. We don't work that way. What the OA preamble used to, I think it was the preamble, contains a line, we've come to believe that the causes of this disease are not important. What deserves the attention of the still suffering compulsive overeater is this: there's a proven and workable method by which we might arrest this illness. And so what deserves my attention isn't this analysis of the cause, because I could be off about that anyway. It could be something more inherent in my genetics. It could be a lot of other things. What deserves my attention is that there is a solution. And the solution is well described in the literature. It's certainly well described in the Big Book. And it tells us, and there is a solution, ironically titled chapter, there is a solution, that the solution it is a spiritual reawakening, a spiritual rearrangement of sufficient depth and weight that changes my outlook on life. I grew up outside. I grew up running and playing. We lived out in the country. Winter and summer, I was outside as much as I could be. I was a pretty good basketball player growing up. I was out shooting baskets. I was out hitting baseballs. I was out running the fields. We fished. We did all the physical things. And so the effects of food, the effects of food that I might have snuck, stolen, or eaten, didn't really start showing up until I was got a little older. And by a little older, I mean around the time I got turned 16 and had an unrestricted driver's license and was also able to get beer. I could walk in. I'm 6'4", and I was this tall as an eighth grader, as freshman in high school. And if they didn't know me, I could walk in most taverns and buy beer. You had to be 18 to get it. But I carried a special shirt so that I wouldn't get busted. But once I got that driver's license, I was able to get out. And my parents, my mother particularly, wasn't controlling my food portions. The weight started to come on, and I reported for football my junior year of high school. I'd gone home at around 2:15 or so the year before, and I reported for football at 2:40, and the basketball coach pulled me aside and said, "You've got to lose 20 pounds by basketball season, and you need to go on a diet and do that." And my first experience with dieting, and that my mother helped me. She packed me a dietary lunch, celery, carrot sticks, and a hamburger patty kind of thing. And I did that. I didn't acknowledge or understand the effects of liquid calories, but still I lost the weight. I'm playing football and working out every day. I'm getting a lot of exercise, and it didn't take much. And I pulled that 20 pounds off and managed to keep it off. I got out of high school, it was a struggle. I always knew I was different on the inside. I always felt different, especially when it came to food and especially when it came to alcohol and when it came to lots of other things. I felt apart from the people around me. I was related to half the kids in my high school because my mother was from such a large family. And, but I still felt different from them, from the cousins. I still felt different from those kids that I grew up with. A lot of those kids were my mother's coffee clutch group. And so we grew up in the sandbox together and on. But I still felt separate from. I always had that feeling. I'm not going to say that I hated myself. I didn't like myself. I was judgmental of myself, judgmental of my reactions to a lot of things. I was hard on myself. I'm a perfectionist, it's a potent stew for somebody with a eating compulsion. After I got out of high school, I messed up. I got married pretty young. I got a girl pregnant that was in high school. She was a senior in high school. I was a sophomore in college. And back then, you married when that happened. There's no other real option even considered. You put a ring on it and went on. So I was married at 19, a father. Because of the battle with my weight, I had some opportunities. I could have played college basketball, junior college, small college, but wanted to, but I didn't. I had that feeling that I had to earn money and support my family. I got And I had this battle going on with food and weight. And, you know, I hit 270 pretty quick, 280 after I got married. She was a pretty good cook. One of the few things that I say is complimentary about her. We went on and had two children, and I got a college degree. I got a degree in architecture, a degree in engineering, and, you know, struggled through. But I began fighting the weight right away. In my 20s and my 30s are a log of attempts to control my weight and my eating and my drinking. But this is about the weight and the eating. You know, I did the pay and weighs three times. I did 500 calories a day prescribed from a doctor with he'd give me hormone shots distilled from the urine of pregnant women. You know, one of those crazy things we do, vitamin B shots, amphetamines. I did that, lost a lot of weight on every one of those things. I'm going to tell you, we lost weight. I was particularly fond of cabbage soup cleanses. We would, because they were short term when we did them, we knew we were doing them for 2 weeks. My wife was kind of a partner in both the eating and the diets, and we'd come to a stopping point, and so we would do the 2 weeks of nothing but cabbage soup and take weight off, and it was not healthy. None of that stuff was healthy for my body. None of that stuff had any long-term positive effect, but it was the only solution I knew, and because I didn't really understand what the problem was, I didn't understand what the solution was. You know, I was fixing the wrong valve. I was turning the wrong knob. I had no idea that it was something that had a spiritual solution that needed a surrender. Went through my 20s, went through my 30s, made and lost a lot of money. We were living in Arizona in the 80s. I got into property development. And of course, you know, the market was just, it was so good that I thought I was a genius, you know, and it was so good until it turned sour. And then it was so bad that it was, that it took me down. And having a lot of money is not a solution for this disease either. You know, you can have $1 million in the bank and still be crazier than a pet coon. And, I was there, I know. And, but the marriage continued to get worse and worse and worse. And I'm not going to take your time up by analyzing all that, other than to say that it got really bad. And I lost my business. I had to go on the road. I ended up, I got hired by a company that wanted me to go. I ended up in South Dakota for a while, finishing a pretty big development up there that was in trouble. Ended up with a lawsuit. The owner, the company was out of Allentown, Pennsylvania. I moved to Allentown. I went to Allentown, lived in a hotel. And my family stayed in Arizona, and I came home one weekend a month and pretended to be married. This was the end of my eating and drinking career, my unfettered eating and drinking career. And, you know, my weight had hit, I remember my weight hit 300 pounds. That was bad, but that just went to a diet. I remember it hitting 400 pounds and was in a doctor's office and the doctor said, told me I was going to drown in my own juices. And just a scary kind of visualization. And I remember thinking that was it, that I was going to change things, that I gritted my teeth and I clenched my fists. And I said, by God, I'm doing it. I'm going to eat right now, and I'm going to lose this weight, and I'm going to be healthy, because, you know, and I walked out of that doctor's office and I got in my truck and I started down the road and I passed one fast food restaurant and I passed a second one and it was lunchtime. And so I pulled in the third one and got two hamburgers and said, I'll start in the morning. And of course, the morning never came. And I know that now when I look back on that, that the problem, the operative thing that was going on there was I was afraid. And what do we do about fear? You know, what do I do about fear? I don't want to feel fear. I don't want to feel resentment. I don't want to feel those things. And how do I not feel them? I drowned them, right? I drowned it in food. I drowned the fear in food. And I drowned the determination in food. So life went on and you know, there almost 40 years old, I was in Arizona, flown in for the weekend, spent it with my wife. We were having all kinds of problems. She was talking about maybe getting out. We'd gone to, we'd set up meetings with counselors. And she, took me to the, took me to the airport to go back to Pennsylvania. And that was 32 years ago yesterday, March the 12th. And I started to get out of her car, which is a story in itself. She told me she was unhappy. And I asked her what did it take to make her happy, a new house, a new car, my shallowness there. And I'd got her a new car. She wanted a 300ZX Nissan. And I bought her a 300ZX Nissan, thought that'd make her happy. Because I certainly wasn't making her happy. But so she took me to the airport and I got out of that 300ZX. And that's was a physical feat in its own right. You know, almost a Harry Houdini kind of a stunt to unfold all this out of a 300ZX Nissan. And so I got out of the car. And she hands me a letter out the window of the car and hits the gas, about tears my hand off, speeding off, because she didn't want to be there when I read the letter saying she wanted a divorce. I got on that airplane that day and I read that letter over and over and over again. And the letter said, led me to sit there and look at my life and realize how bankrupt I was, emotionally bankrupt, spiritually bankrupt, physically bankrupt, morally bankrupt, I hit a wall. We'd already been to a counselor individually, not together, because in Arizona, in order to get a divorce, if you have minor children and one of our kids wasn't 18 yet, you have to at least try to fix the marriage. So we've gone to counselors and I've been one time to a counselor and that counselor had said to me, he's 20 years sober in AA. And he said, he listened to me for an hour and he said, here's what I want you to do. He said, I want you to go to Overeaters Anonymous. And he said, I want you to go for a year. And he said, once you've been there for a year, if you're ready to come back here and be honest with me, then come back and see me and maybe we'll do some work. And in other words, a man sat there and called me a liar, but I was a liar. You know, I'd sit there and not told him the truth about anything. You know, my ego was trying to protect my self-image. And I had not been, it'd be a wrong to say I'd not been completely honest. I had not been honest. I didn't know how to be honest about who I was. So I left that doctor's, I flew that day, excuse me. I flew back to Allentown, all my plane changes. And those days of traveling were usually drinking and eating days. You know, I'd eat in the airport in Phoenix. I would have a few drinks. I'd get on an airplane. Usually changing planes in Atlanta or Chicago, and I'd eat and drink on the plane, whatever they served. And then I would get to the airport that I was going to change planes in, and I'd find a bar, a place, and I would eat something there and drink something there, and then fly to usually Newark, and I would, you know, eat whatever was available. and drink whatever was available on the plane to Newark. And by the time I got to Newark, I was in pretty bad shape. And I'd get on the shuttle, usually in Newark, and take the shuttle back to Allentown, and have to be almost poured out of the shuttle at my room because I was in pretty bad shape. But those were traveling days. I had no responsibilities, so they were just good days to do that. But that day, and for 32 years now, I haven't had a drink. I wish I could say that for 32 years I'd been abstinent, but that would be a lie. I do have 5.5 years, but the food was the harder thing to handle. But I went to an OA meeting that night, and I got a sponsor, and the sponsor said, the sponsor told me that alcohol was bad for my food plan, and so we let that go, and he said to get extra meetings in, find you an AA meeting. So I found a noon AA meeting every day, and I was going to a meeting at noon for AA, and I was going to a OA meeting every evening, except there wasn't a good meeting on Saturdays. It was one on Sundays. So 6 days a week, I was getting an OA meeting, and 5 days a week, I was getting an AA meeting, and I was going to an NA meeting with some girls that were going to OA because I was knew I was going to be single, and these girls were cute. So it looked like a good place to me to meet the next Mrs. Wright. So was doing a lot of meetings, and I got a sponsor, and wish I could tell you that I got a sponsor that pushed me through the steps, that helped me to go hard with the steps. But he handed me 32 Westminster questions, and I answered them. And that was supposed to be the first three steps back then. And we got to the fourth step, and I wrote what I thought I was supposed to write. And he said, "That's okay, but you didn't go far enough." And, you know, my low self-esteem that is masked by my bravado said, "You're not good enough. You're not able to do a good enough job." That, you know, that inner self judgment came out, and you know, that part of me that I don't like. And then that sponsor relapsed shortly after that, and I got stalled. And at about a year abstinent, I moved to Tulsa. The job there ended, and I was in the middle of the divorce. I got a job here, not quite that clean, but that's how it worked out. And I moved here, found OA here, got involved with a woman here. I was going to pick up my 2-year chip here. I'm going to tell you, I'd lost 145 pounds in that first year, by the way. You know, going to meetings and eating a tight food plan and getting some of the program, but I couldn't tell you I really had that effective spiritual experience, that rearrangement that's promised. I kept praying and asking God to give that to me, and I didn't understand that the 12th step says that having had a spiritual experience as the result of the steps, that if I want that spiritual rearrangement, if I want that inner rearrangement, that I have to do what the program asked me to do, which means that I have to work the steps thoroughly and work the steps diligently and honestly and not hold back. But, you know, for me, there were certain things I didn't want to admit to, certain people I didn't want to make amends to. And, you know, I was holding back. I was bargaining with that fourth and fifth step. I was bargaining with my eighth and ninth step. Because, you know, why should I make amends to somebody that I felt like it hurt me as much as I hurt them, for instance? So I was holding back. I was holding back. I was holding back. But it started me in a pattern of getting anywhere from, you know, 10 days to 6 months of abstinence. I was a chronic relapser. And you know, and those stories alone, I could fill an hour, but most of us know the game, you know. I would get that 6-month chip, and then I'd be off eating again, and I would get the a 90-day chip, and I'd be off eating again, and then I'd give up, and then I would get excited and go after it again. In the middle of that, at one point, my weight came back on, and I went from a low of around 240 back up. I hit 520 in relapse. My son, the woman that I met here, and I had a son together. My third son, and I went to his son's first birthday party today. Just a wonderful kid, great young man. But I went to his birthday party, one time here 10 years ago or more. And he was driving, and I asked him to park closer to the front door of the restaurant, so I didn't have to walk so far to get in. And he started crying and said that he felt like I was killing myself with the food, and that he didn't want that to happen. And that this kid, fine, thank you. This kid's 6'6", and about 300 pounds of solid muscle, and played college football. And he started crying and said that I had to do something. And so I went to see how, and I lost weight, but I didn't get the step thing I tripped over it. The workbook method of doing the steps just didn't work for me. And they were only letting me do a question a day. And it was, if I could stay abstinent long enough to get through that workbook, I wouldn't need this program. But so I went, I lost some weight, but I relapsed again, and I was back in it. And finally I ended up in the hospital, and I won't go into detail on that. I had lymphedema in my legs, and it got a septic infection in it. And they were talking about maybe needing to cut my legs off at the knees. Maybe if they don't do something, I could die. I'm in the hospital for 3 weeks. My friend, the mother of that youngest child, 12th stepped me in the hospital. Even though I had been around 25 years, she said there was a program, a meeting on the phone every morning that was a big book oriented meeting where they talked about working the steps quickly. And she gave me a sponsor's name, and a man that many of you may know in Arizona, gave me his phone number, and I called him, and he took me on as a sponsee, and we worked the steps quickly. And I'm going to tell you, I've been abstinent since that day. I sponsor anywhere from 8 to 12 people at a time. It's most of my life. I know that we recover in order to live. We don't live to recover, perhaps, but that is life for me. Being able to help other people, that is the essence of life for me. It's what I pray and ask God to show me how to do every day. And so in this process, I've lost a lot of weight, but it's coming off slow. It is coming off. I'm 70 years old. It's not coming off like it did when I was 40, 30 years ago when I first came in. Because of the problems with my legs, I'm not able to exercise aerobically very well. And I'm diabetic. But it's coming off. And if I hadn't have this program, if I didn't have this spiritual awakening that comes as a result of these steps, I think the frustration over that would have done me in by now. But I think that on the other hand, that had I lost the weight real quickly again, if I was back down to playing weight, I think God knows that that probably wouldn't have been the best thing for me, because it would have become just another diet and calories club. It would have become another way for me to go back out and look for the next Miss Right, you know, to be doing the things that other than the things of God. And I have to take it as a blessing that it's been slow, that it's been tediously slow, because in the meantime, I'm learning so much and I'm growing so much and I'm finding that deepening connection with God. And I don't think I could ask for a better way of life than a deep connection with the God of my understanding. And so I'm going to continue on that path and continue to live a life of surrender and acceptance and inventory and reflection. And with that, I'm going to pass, because I think it's time. Thank you.